And we're back. I am Louis Fertel, now the sole survivor of Keep It. I've successfully eliminated all of my competition. You will remember last week that Aida Osman, our friend, host of Keep It, was here. She has to attend to personal matters for the next couple weeks, so she is gone yet again. I know it seems like she's negging you, the incel community, but she's not. I swear she will be back. But today I have two of just my all-time favorites here, including last week's co-champion of Keep It, Guy Branum. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad to hear it because you need to be here. And also, my dear friend, Solomon Giorgio, are returning to Keep It himself. I'm so thrilled you guys are both here. Welcome to the show.
Happy to do it.
It's Akbar in 2013.
Okay, well, I'm actually going to start with Akbar right off the top. Solomon and I, last week, were at a bar, Akbar, a famous gay bar in LA. Mm-hmm. I've brought it up before. There was a child next to us of maybe 23 years of age. He was wearing a scarf. He was one of these people, okay? Mm-hmm. So he thought he knew everything. This bastard sits down, and he, out of nowhere, like a maniac, like somebody on drugs, says, "Where are the good Paula Abdul songs?" and calls her a hack to us.
Oh my God.
Yes. Yes.
Solomon and I, who are, you know, on the Mount Rushmore of Akbar, we like belong on the board, freak the fuck out. We start explaining to this child, first of all, Paula Abdul for the longest time held the record for number one hits on an album with Forever Your Girl. We had to explain to this child that she made Janet Jackson move, as in she's like, she was the animator of Janet Jackson.
It is literally Janet Jackson's pivotal moment in change, and her dance moves is Paula Abdul.
Yes.
I mean, the way that you love me. I mean,
oh yes,
it, like that tape, as it should only be referred to, was truly nothing but hits in a way that we didn't experience again until five young ladies were put together by a music producer in London and gave us 20 nothing but hits over the course of two albums. Like, that's, but also I feel like, isn't it a definitive experience of being a gay boy who has decided he is wise for his age to say bullshit like that and then be ground to dust by the likes of you two? Like, how will they learn otherwise?
Look, the soapbox that we pulled out and the, the level of shrillness our voices got to based on the disrespect.
No, it was like Statler and Waldorf going through puberty is what it sounded like. And also, I mean, like, I kept going. My mind was reeling. I was like, maybe she was an easy hire for American Idol and had nothing going on at that time. But you have no idea what was going on during the Spellbound era with Vibology, with Rush. So it's just, it was stressful to me that I had to basically give the entire Wikipedia for Paula Abdul to somebody who was trying to upset me to begin with, I believe.
Nice. Well, I mean, if male homosexuality means anything, it is seeing a woman and saying, who's she? As the photos behind Lewis of Sandy Dennis and Lee Grant currently attest.
That's
and
right.
Just the fact that this boy has not done the reading for class, really, he needs to reevaluate himself.
And also, it's like once upon, I mean, nowadays, it feels like actually most of our pop stars wear blazers and leotards. But Paula, I believe, originated that, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
Maybe Vanity 6 was first. I don't know. I'll have to go to the books on that one.
She, like, just like her VMA performances alone should settle her, like, in history, and not to have that knowledge, that's just a shame. That's a true shame.
Now we've set the groundwork for what we're, the dynamic I'm establishing here today, which is gay know-it-allism at its finest. That's what Keep It is today. We have a lot of fun stuff going on. First of all, Simon Rex is here, and if you have not seen the film Red Rocket yet, which is the newest Sean Baker joint, he of course did Tangerine and Florida Project, Simon Rex turns it the fuck out. I thought it was going to be a good performance. This is a competitive performance. As I'm thinking, is it him or Will Smith or Andrew Garfield I like the most? So I'm thrilled to be talking with him today. And we'll be getting into what we're missing without the Golden Globes in the world. I found I was lacking a lot of drunken Tom Hanks action over the weekend. So we'll get into what's up with that. And of course, it wouldn't be Keep It in 2022 if we didn't unpack a few horrifying celebrity deaths. And I thought we would start off with one I don't believe we spent enough time talking about, period, which was Sidney Poitier. Did you guys go to town and watch anything of his? Because I actually watched three of his movies this weekend.
Which ones?
I had actually seen them all before. But my favorite, which is A Patch of Blue, which I feel like goes under discussed, To Sir with Love. Because we were very into London school teaching for a while in society. And then also Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which I think has aged the least well, but we really needed him in movies, I guess exclusively, just to teach people lessons for a while.
Yeah.
He was like the crossing guard of society, like just like telling white people where to walk and how to be for a little while.
I mean, it's one of the things, which one did he, the one with the nuns that he won the Academy Award for?
Oh, Lilies of the Field, yes.
Lilies of the Field almost, I mean, at a point in time when we truly did require that of Sidney Poitier from every film, like, Lilies of the Field is almost the one that just sort of, like, gets to sit on its own terms the most and just be a cute, dumb little sister-acty sort of, like, comedy with nuns, and it makes me happy that that's what he won for instead of one of these more turgid, what if a black man and a white man had to be handcuffed together for a period of time.
Well, he's like, for me, I will always remember Heat of the Night, because that is the first time I think in cinematic history we had a movie about a cop on like, that's had it. Like, it's like, I'm done with this job. I hate everything about it. Like, it's very much like the Denzel Washington. Like, that's like other black actors made whole careers out of this, like, fed up black man at a job character that Sidney Poitier created for Heat of the Night. And I just, yeah, he's really set the groundwork for so much acting that is still done to this day.
There's also something about him, like, even though in a lot of these movies, in retrospect, it feels like he's just being didactic or, you know, having to deal with idiots. And a lot of the time you're watching him and thinking, I wish he was just with other characters who were as, like, rad as he is, you know, because he often didn't get to be. But I think the thing that makes it particularly watchable even now is there's always something about him that felt discerning. So even if something is, like, tedious on one level with the other characters in the movie, you can see on his face it's registering deeply how annoying it is. And even though he's using restraint and diplomacy to handle the situation, you can almost see in his mind like a shut the fuck up. You know.
Lewis, have you found the TV Academy's the videos of TV legends that they have all over YouTube?
We just talked about Betty White last week. I mean, like, all these people have these amazing interviews.
They're really good. But the ones I watched, a long one with Sidney Poitier where he was talking about how his literacy journey sort of shaped his delivery as an actor, because, like, you know, he came from the Bahamas when he was really young. He was having to work from a really young age. He had to leave school when he was 12, and about how being somebody who spent several years of his life with sort of, like, you know, low literacy levels, and then, like, working with, like, a waiter at one of his jobs to get better at reading, like, longer words, that he basically chewed on these words and delivered them and thought about them. And there was something in, like, a Katharine Hepburn-y kind of way so unique about his delivery, because he was thinking and being in words as he was saying them.
Yes. No, there is something about the declarative nature of what he's saying, even when he's not having a big monologue, that is very engaging. And also would not work with almost anybody nowadays. It's like the best kind of acting you can do in 1967. Though it is fun watching him and Katharine Hepburn, who is, I mean, a world-class trembler, but trembling throughout Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Well, also, I mean, I have no class of films that I love more than films Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy decided to do because they were going to prove a point. Your Adam's Rib, your Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
That's a movie that also culminates with Spencer Tracy explaining that he's learned something, which is so, it's just such a hilarious way to tie up a movie. Like, oh, thank God it's your journey I'm on throughout this whole fucking thing. Yeah.
Well, but also watching, like Sidney Poitier and Katharine Hepburn are both gigantic performers. Spencer Tracy is, like, dying during the movie. So, but his performances were also always at a four. And then also you've got Katharine Hepburn's niece there. God knows why.
And this is her literal niece. Katherine Houghton plays his fiance in the movie. You also brought up a good point, Guy, on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken, about how Sidney Poitier in obituaries was rarely referred to as Sir Sidney Poitier.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it was, I could only find the Times of London that was doing it. And I mean, he was alive, like, that his death was announced by the government of the Bahamas, because yeah. there's no more famous Bahamian. But it was really interesting to me that he was not referred to as such by, I think, anyone I could find other than the Times of London. And it was just one of those moments of, like, is this person getting the respect that they would have gotten if they were a white Briton, you know?
Right. It's we just simply forgot to make that a part of his name sometimes, whereas, like,
yes.
Dame Maggie Smith, I mean, those are the four syllables that go together, you know right. what I mean? So thank you for journalistically and rather tediously making sure we
acknowledge that he is a sir.
Yes, right. To sir with even more love. Yes, right. We'll be back in a moment. We're going to talk about another celebrity death and then hopefully launch into a more optimistic conversation via Bob Saget and discuss camaraderie and comedy. We're with two stand-ups today. Maybe they have a bunch of friends in comedy. Maybe they're all alone. We'll discover it in a moment. On Sunday night, a house in heaven got a little fuller. Ooh. Brian is getting Brian Semmel is getting spicy with the intros this week. Beloved dirty stand-up turned sitcom dad Bob Saget died at the age of 65, very unexpectedly. As soon as news of his passing dropped, comedians from every generation began sharing their stories. And frankly, I knew they would. There's something always about a funny person passing away where I can expect hearing not just funny stories about them, but how, like, they have a very particular special bond with the people they worked with for years, ran into on the road for years. And I just wanted to talk with you two about what the fuck that is. What is this, like, familial thing that necessarily happens between comedians? Is it always a good thing? Do you experience it yourself?
Yeah, I feel like there's the bond that we have is that we feel like we went through, we experienced the trenches of starting stand-up, which is truly a hellscape that only comedians understand. So whenever we lose one, it's such a big impact, especially somebody who has no one has anything mean to say about, which is always impressive for a male comic, especially.
Yeah, I mean, it like Solomon, I don't know how many experiences you had with Bob Saget. I only really had one, but the really cool thing about it was also a situation where he and John Stamos were working together again and seeing, like, their rapport and charm with one another and how much they loved each other was really lovely. But the thing I will say about Bob Saget is, like, he made the dirtiest jokes and he made the meanest jokes, but he also had a sense of, like, stand-up should come with a sense of humility because you're gonna fail. And he always had that sense of humility. And there's just such a difference between somebody, like, taking a dig at someone or something, but being able to just sort of say, like, that was a joke and not need to turn it into a lifestyle or a philosophy, which I think is really what saved him. Like, also just being so funny. Like, the thing is when you're a level of funny, when you have a level of confidence with the work that you're doing, you don't necessarily need to, like, double down on HGH or anti-vaxxing or how trans people aren't people.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think, like, for me, I think people, like, they do such a big juxtaposition from his role as Danny Tanner to his stand-up. And I think that person exists in both, like, you can have those characteristics in one person. Somebody who will tell the filthiest, grossest jokes and still be able to portray an amazing dad because he has those aspects. And I think that's, like, there's always going to be that camaraderie, but I also, like, him, he's, like, a special treat because no one, like, the character of Danny Tanner, which is, like, the most effeminate father figure on television ever created, and being able to make that character come to life, that's just, not anybody can just do that. Somebody has to have that in their heart.
First of all, Robert Reed, a.k.a. Mike Brady, would like a word. That was a Queenie-ass dad. And you can look at the way he is an architect, just for starters.
Very true,
just
but he was
the straight
raising
lines
boys.
Alone. That's true. That's true. That's true. Well, actually, what's interesting to me is, as you said, people are describing the juxtaposition of who he was on Full House with who he was as a comic. But honestly, you can sort of see the layers in Full House. Like, he's being very sweet, but there's always something registering in his eyes, like a note of cynicism or a note of resignment.
Yes.
And it reminds me of what's coming to mind is like John Arbuckle from Garfield. It's like, you know, I'm doing my best with these rascals, but gulp, I'm who I am. You know?
It's that little bit of edge that, say, maybe other stand-up comedians who were in the cast of Full House weren't bringing to the table because they were too busy with puppets. One thing that was so, like, a weird thing about stand-up is, like, we lose a lot of people. We have lost a lot of people to suicide. We have lost a lot of people to drugs. We have lost a lot of people to, you know, the random things that kill people. Was my weird mix of emotions about the fact that this dude died in a Ritz-Carlton in Florida, which is like, on the one hand, this very sort of like sad, he died alone, you know, and you're very much sort of like, which of these is going to take me? When Brody Stevens took his own life, there was a little bit of me that was like, will this be me one day? And when Bob Saget died in a Ritz-Carlton in Florida, it was like, will this be me one day? But there's also this way that it's like, he died with his sword in his hand.
Yeah,
in this
right.
very sort of like interesting way where I can't see it as sad because like he had like children and a wife and family and all of that. But there's also something so beautiful that this other part of his life was built up. And like his last tweet was about how much he was loving the process of being on stage again. Solomon, like, what are your feelings when these things happen?
It is so sad, but it's also like, based on the person's, like, especially something like him, like he has a legacy that's going to last forever. And that's kind of what we all want as comics is like, even regardless of how we pass away, we want our impact to be stronger than our death. And he managed to do that. He managed to be one of the few comics to become such an insane multi-hyphenate that we can't even fully consider him just a stand-up comic anymore. He's literally more than that. So that's why I think that's one thing we all want is just to leave this world with an impact that will last forever.
It's fucking crazy that his last tweet is him being like, I just realized how much I'm appreciating this moment of what I do. I mean, it was like the end of a movie written by Nicholas Sparks or something. it reminds me of one of my old favorites who I bring up a lot. I'm sure I've discussed her with guys several times, but Cass Elliot. Yeah. Like minutes before she died was on the phone with Michelle Phillips, fellow mama of Mamas and the Papas, saying she had just gotten a standing ovation and couldn't believe how well her concert went. It's like, I'm not saying I want you to die after something like that happens, but there is just something so poetically satisfying to my simple mind about things like that, you know?
But I mean, Lewis, to sort of like the broader question you were asking about like camaraderie and stand-up is there is this way that you feel bonded to these people or that you have a set of experiences that you share and you just understand them. And there's also this way that like we within our community are constantly sharing in this very strange way. Like the vast majority of the time I learn about Solomon's life, you know, sometimes it is at a bar, but a lot of the time it is just from a joke that he is telling or something like that. And you like know these people and you have such a strange relationship with them. But one of the things that has been really hard and complex over the last couple of years is the conditional status that's given to some people within that world. The frequency with which, you know, women or queer people who push back within stand-up suddenly aren't comics anymore. Yeah. Like, we have this friend who sort of, like, had a tussle with a more established comic, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and you know, he's somebody who figured out that he made a mistake, and so I'm not going to say his name. But in all of it, he was referred to as a comic, and she was referred to as a blogger. Mm. And, like, this is a comic who was running shows and running mics and doing more to keep the comedy world alive than that dude was at that point in time. And it just kind of kills me that kind of solidarity that I give so lovingly to so many of these people can be conditionally denied to people like me.
I agree. But I feel like there's always going to be gatekeeping in this wonderful world of ours. But we're defiant, which I think is nice. And we also have people that are also up up top that do a great job of making sure that we're still considered stand-ups.
Is it annoying to kind of have to be quote unquote grateful to the people who basically reach out and make sure you feel like a human member of the community just because you're black or gay or something, and needing someone from the top? Like, I don't know, like for years, just for example, on Twitter, you know who's always retweeted me? I mean, it's a simple gesture, who cares? But like Patton Oswalt, a part of me is still in my mind thinking, oh, that's so nice of him. It's like, I mean, and it's not nice of him, but why am I like grateful? It's like, no, I'm fucking funny. Why wouldn't you retweet me? Anyway, but it's one of those things where you grow up thinking like, as a queer person, like, all right, a part of me is always a little bit of like, not embarrassing to straight people, but like a little bit much for them. And so when they reach out to you and, you know, make you and say to other people, oh, this person's funny, it feels not just like, I think this is funny, but advocating for something that you might be uncomfortable with. And it's like, but anyway, I just think that's like a weird, like self-deprecating thing I go through sometimes dealing with other straight funny people.
Yeah, I'm looking up the definition of the word grateful. I don't think I've ever attempted it, but I'll give it a try one day.
The thing is just like when I started many, many years ago, like the system was so man to man that I can't help but be grateful. You know, I can't help but be grateful of the like straight guys who are broad-minded enough to think that they could take a woman they're not having sex with on the road or a gay person on the road. And also, like, it was a time when so many of the gay men who were working were just like, there's only enough room for one, that they didn't have the space in their minds or hearts to be generous with stuff like that, which is why I'm so much more grateful to someone like Wanda Sykes, who has just been consistently present for women, people of color, and queer people, and is like, she and her partner, Paige Hurwitz, have made a business out of this. And I like being grateful. Like, there's just something, it's just so nice to, instead of focusing on, because there's so much negative to focus on, and because it is, as Solomon said, it's a hard business, and there are gatekeepers. And when you find people who are kind enough to be generous, it's just so lovely. And I also think as a reminder, like, you have enough to be generous. In whatever position you are in, you have enough to be generous.
Yeah, I'm on board. I do fully agree. Like, I am grateful, but I'm not specifically grateful to anybody straight or male. Like, that's, I feel like they should give me, like, in those situations, I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely just as funny as you are. I'm not, like, but people who, like, because there is, like, a lot of the gatekeeping that I've seen is also by people that fall in the same category as me, where I'm like, that's what I, like, I'm definitely, when there's those of us who are still open and willing to, like, bring on other people, that's what I'm like, this is wonderful, to not be mad and angry at the world for making you go through something and therefore having to throw it on other people. That's the kind of situations I despise, and I love it when I don't have it.
Because at the end of the day, like, a certain level of talent allows you to not be bitter, because you're like, well, I'm going to go be on stage and be funny. And the people who are working hard on us to say you're not a stand-up probably aren't that funny and have just been at the club for over 7 years.
Well, it reminded me of how annoying the conversation about the recent Dave Chappelle special was, because he, while delivering, for instance, the turf agenda or whatever was going on there, no one ever said, well, this isn't stand-up. Meanwhile, when Hannah Gadsby had her special and had whatever 3 minutes where she's explaining a terrible event, suddenly people are obsessed with announcing it's a one-woman show and not stand-up anymore. Well, and it's like, why is this distinction important only now?
To be fair, Hannah Gadsby was like, well, I'm not doing stand-up anymore, which kind of pissed me off, because it lets everyone have their cake and eat it too. It lets the Chappelle people be like, she's not a real stand-up, and it lets queer people and women like be like smugly like, we're better than stand-up. And it's like, no, I'm exactly as good as stand-up. And it pisses me off a little bit that, look, I was Nanette impacted me and it made me think about the thing that I do differently, and I really respect it. But it's also like, Jacqueline Novak did a fucking hour of nothing but dick jokes that contemplated women's perspective in this world and what it means to have a body. And that is what makes me happy, is people who are bringing their intelligence and their talent to the table to take this form that I love and is so much fun and fill it with different perspectives that show us our lives differently.
Just, that special is called get on your knees, correct? Yes. I'm going to give Jacqueline Novak the full credit there. Sorry to interrupt you.
For me, it's like anybody who tries to put specific boundaries in the world of stand-up is not a true stand-up to me. That's where I find the issue with. Anyone who says all that's required is you going on that stage and making people laugh. And sometimes that's not even required, honestly. It's just going on that stage, really. But that's essentially what it is. And I'm not going to, I feel like it's just unfair to strip the meaning of what it is based on what your personal definition of what stand-up is. And I don't think it's fair. And I think it's always, if you don't show up to appreciate stand-up with an open mind, then why are you even there, honestly?
Solomon, it sounds like you're sticking your neck out for Che Diaz on And Just Like That. I believe she has the potential to be funny. Or pardon me, I believe they have the potential to be funny. Yes.
I've only been watching And Just Like That through memes, so I'm not 100% sure.
I'll be honest, I think you got the gist. I'll be honest.
Yeah.
Not much nuance left to plumb there, I don't think. Do you guys have just favorite comics you're friends with who you rather unexpectedly ended up friends with?
I mean, my oldest school best friend from stand-up is this, like, comedy seller comic in New York, Louis Katz, who is just sort of, like, who disagrees with me about all of this stuff, almost, but he's, like, interested and engaged in having conversations. Like, you know, he's basically someone who's always going to tell me that I'm wrong about, you know, the newest Chappelle Hour or whatever, and we'll fight about it, but it's fun, and he's interesting, and he's smart, and that's why it is really fun, like, these times and moments when, like, someone as talky and thinking and I am hanging around with somebody who gets on stage and just fights with a microphone for 10 minutes or whatever. Like, it is all of these different styles and voices. Our friend Emily Heller once said, it's the most diverse art form I've ever been a part of. And it's just true.
Yeah.
Because when you get on stage, whoever is there is in charge. Like, yeah, like Dave Chappelle can command a room when he's behind a microphone. But Aparna Nancherla, the quietest, most retiring, most thoughtful of others human being, is also a cruel tyrant when she is behind that microphone. And I love it.
That's true.
I just want to say that one time I was at Guy's Seder, which at the time the term had to be basically explained to me. I famously did not meet a Jewish person until I was 18. But I was sat next to Aparna, and this is years and years ago. I don't think I even knew who she was yet. And she wasn't saying much. And I was like doing, you know, I was doing my like nervously over social thing. And it occurred to me very quickly, this person was legions ahead of me in terms of funny and just like deploying like the softest bombs, and like it wasn't deflating to me exactly, but I didn't know what I was in for, and I think she constantly delivers that as a stand-up.
The softest bombs is the best way of describing her.
See, can my compatriot is Marcel Arguello, and that is there's parts of me that I'm like, we're very similar. I'm like, no, we're not. She is in a different league of like commanding that I wish I could get, but in my head I am her, but that's not true at all.
I love, she is just very, in addition to funny, strident. Like, there's something about her that says like, I actually don't give a fuck, and a lot of people would claim that, and her delivery and also when you know her, like her, like her like radness, her niceness also indicates that.
Yes,
you know?
I in the dumbest, most depressive New Year's way DM'd her and came at her about something dumb on Twitter, and she Marcella'd back at me so hard, and then like I just sort of, but with like, Marcella Arguello is the kind of comic I respect most, who is the hardest and the kindest at the same time, and it was just like within the past 3 months the best articulation of what stand-up is what that woman presented me of not backing down, telling me why I was wrong, and when I apologize, telling me, you don't have to apologize. This is just who we are. And I am so grateful. Like, getting to be a stand-up comedian is one of the richest things in my life. I love it like I love my family. I love it like I love being gay. And it's why it's so beautiful to see people reach out with so much love when something tragic like this happens.
And my answer would, of course, be you two would probably be my answers for like stand-ups I'm happiest to know. But also specifically because like something that really upsets me is the amount of times you hear in a discussion about why something is offensive or whatever, that quote unquote funny is funny. And that's where the conversation ends. But I think with like the comics I care about anyway, the conversation's never over. It's barely begun. You can always get into it. And like getting into the zeros and ones of comedy is never not fun to me. Mm-hmm. And staying super articulate and super just aware of what we're doing when we're being funny and who we're appealing to and who we're maybe even leaving out sometimes is like always interesting because it's never just funny is funny. There's always it's funny to someone and it's not funny to someone and there's a why. Yeah. And I just think from that part, there's just always something to learn there and always something interesting.
Oh,
so anyway, thank you for being a part of that conversation. When we're back, why don't we hang out with Simon Rex? Should be great.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcast and on YouTube.
Our guest today is a real Renaissance man. You might know him as an MTV VJ. Actually, it's fascinating the ways you may know who this person is. Really interesting. You might know him as a comedy staple of the early aughts, might know him as a rapper, but in his newest incarnation, he's an Oscar contender for his leading role in Sean Baker's Red Rocket. Please welcome Simon Rex. Welcome to Keep It.
Oh, thank you for having me, guys. Forgive me if I'm a little jet lag. I just got off an airplane and raced right over. But sometimes being jet lag and out of it adds to comedy and more fun.
Oh, yes. Oh, wow. Helps.
You're like a comedy scientist. You're aware of what goes into the potion of this.
I'm not that smart. I just have a theory that sometimes, like, I actually, it's sort of how this movie Red Rocket happened. Sometimes the less you try and the less you overthink it, the more magic happens. So let's have some magic.
Well, something that's interesting to me is, so you're obviously thrust into a gigantic press junket right now, which I am sure is like an upheaval of your life in certain ways. How is it just answering 100 questions about one experience again and again? Is it, do you take to it well?
Yeah, it just becomes like a muscle memory or something. And you know, I haven't had anything like this in about 10 years. So it's been a while since I even had to do a movie like Red Rocket and do press like this. It's been a decade. So it took a minute to get, you know, back into the groove. But then once you get in the flow, it just becomes just natural.
And you, as you just indicated, I didn't realize this when I was watching the movie. You got this role, the starring role in this Sean Baker movie, something like 3 days before it started filming, and you drove yourself to the location so you wouldn't have to be quarantined?
Yeah. So how it happened was I live in Joshua Tree out in the desert, and I was just this was July 2020, and there was not much going on for anybody, especially like shooting films and things. And I get a phone call from a friend who's friends with Sean Baker's sister. And she goes, "Hey, do you know who Sean Baker is?" I was like, "Yeah, of course. He wants to, can I give him your phone number? He wants to call you." "Oh yeah, no problem." So he calls me and says, "Hey Simon, I know this is crazy. Can you do me a favor and just read this one paragraph and put it on your phone?" It was this phone, "and send it to me." So I just basically did a cold read, which means not very rehearsed, like what we were just talking about, less planning. And I just did it right here on my phone and sent it to him, and he loved it. And the next day he called me up and he said, "I need you in Texas in 3 days, but if I fly you here, we have to quarantine you, and that would fall into production. So you need to drive here. So we have a rental car waiting for you down the street. Get over here." And I basically just drove 3 days from Joshua Tree to Southeast Texas, and basically just had to like work on the script in hotel rooms because it was a 3-day drive, and kind of as I was driving down, you know, a straight road for hundreds of miles, and it just got thrown right. I got thrown right into it. But I, again, I think that's it worked for this film because the character and the whole way this film was made was very low budget, guerrilla, indie, almost felt like a student film. We had a 10-person crew. We were just running and gunning. So it kind of made sense and worked because if I had rehearsed it for 3 months every day, it might have lost the magic.
I should establish quickly before we get into our question. This is a movie about a porn star returning home to his very rural hometown and basically disrupting everybody's lives with his rampant narcissism and his amazing personality, but also shocking personality. I will now defer to my co-hosts if they would like to ask about this tremendous performance, yeah. Which, by the way, better get you nominated for an Oscar. And I'm not just saying that because you're here. Like, there are some, like, superstars in the running this year, and you are fucking just as good as them. So I am so fucking psyched if it happens. Yeah,
I mean, thank you.
That's what my question is, because, like, so much of your career has been a mix of acting and hosting and personality work and stuff like that. And with, like, such a big character like this, were you surprised that, like, the LA Film Critics Association and all of these people have been able to recognize it as an acting performance and not just as, like, an extension of your persona? You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't even know what the LA Film Critic Association was until I got it. Like, I haven't been, even when I was working a lot as an actor 20 years ago, it was doing movies like Scary Movie, which is great. You know, those movies are awesome. They're funny. They're, you know, for the whole family. I love doing those very broad comedies. But I never was in any films that would, you know, get me attention from any film critics or awards, you know, this. So this is all new to me. So, yeah, it's I knew when we were shooting the movie that we had something special. You could just tell sometimes, but I've been wrong before. I've been on movie sets where you're shooting something like, this is it. This is going to be amazing. And you go see it and you're like, what happened? How did this movie get sabotaged? And on the other side of the coin, I've done films that I was like, oh, this movie's going to suck. And it came out good. So I've learned to just, I don't know anything. But with Sean Baker, just seeing his films and knowing that he's the writer, or no, he's the casting director, the writer, the director, and the editor, that his vision was going to be, you know, his vision, as opposed to having producers standing over his shoulder telling him, oh, you got to do this. And, you know, I mean, he even chooses the font on the poster. I mean, he does everything. And I felt very safe in his hands. And actually, going backwards a little bit, when he called me to come do the movie, he said, Simon, I know you don't know me, but do you trust me? And I did. And I never met him before. I said, I do trust you. He said, okay, good, because you're not going to make any money. I'm not going to make any money. I just need you to get out here. We're going to make a really cool movie. And I don't want to deal with your agents or managers because we have no time to negotiate the contract. Trust me, you're going to just make barely any money and we're going to make a cool movie. I said, I'm in. Oh, did that great. Answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. I kind of went off on a tangent there.
It was very true to your character in the movie, actually. As far as I know, this is all good junketeering. You're selling the character very well.
That actually goes back to what you were saying about how, you know, I think there's a huge difference between me and the character of Mikey Saber in our moral compass and our ethics. But I think that I could talk 100 miles an hour like he can. The difference is that he's manipulating people and he's hurting people and he's just, you know, not aware of his actions. I could talk 100 miles an hour, but I'm hypercognizant of being hurting people and not, you know, not rocking the boat. So it's easy for me to tap into the, you know, the fast dialogue, which this movie required. But, you know, it's all about intention. And I think the thing with Mikey is that I think that the saving grace is, a lot of people say when they see this movie, they're like, why am I rooting for this guy? I don't understand. I feel conflicted, that's good writing on Sean's part. And it's because maybe Mikey doesn't know what he's doing. And it's like a little dog pissing on the rug. And it's like, oh, I can't get mad at him. He's just a puppy peeing on the rug. He doesn't mean to. So I feel like that's what works for this film, is that his intentions might not be bad. Maybe he's just on survival autopilot and everyone can relate to that on a human level. And he's just surviving. So, but it's very easy for me to bop, 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 bop.
I mean, I want to add that you literally are calling to mind friends I have who are lots of fun. They're an adventure every time you go out with them. They bring, quote unquote, the party. But in fact, they are a baby. Like you, it's like you're strapping yourself into some caution tape when you're hanging out with them. But like, that's the whole point of being with them ultimately.
Yeah, we all know this guy or girl. We have them in our family, that we work with them. We went to school with them. We know them. So I think that's another reason why this movie works and this character works, is because we've all been exhausted by this person, yet we find them charming and endearing. But yet my mom calls them energy vampires. Like, you hang out with them for 10 minutes and you're sucked of your life force. And you're like, why do I feel like I need a nap after hanging out with this person for 10 minutes? Jesus. So it was easy for me to play because I live in LA for 20 years. I'm surrounded by delusional narcissists that think they're going to make it in show business. So it was very easy for me to portray this type of personality type. I can't clinically diagnose it, but I would say he's a narcissistic sociopath possibly. But I don't know. I'm no doctor.
This town runs on that though. So yeah. he's an essential cog in the industry.
Exactly. He's a cock in this industry. Sorry, had to do it.
Like, you've had like a really varied and fun and interesting career, but like this film is changing your profile and perspective. Like, what would you like to get to do because this is happening for you? Like, what would be a cool next step?
That's a great question. I'm having a lot of, it's funny because the offers are pouring in. A year ago, I would have killed for some of these offers that are coming in. And for the first time in a very long time, I'm saying no to things because I want to do the right thing. And I think the question is, I always want to do comedy. You know, this movie is a dark comedy, but it also has a lot of real grounded, vulnerable, serious, dramatic acting moments. And I think that's what people are surprised to see that I always knew I could do, but I was never given an opportunity to. And that's, Sean saw it in me and gave me the chance. Thank you, Sean Baker. Was that, you know, people saw me as this scary movie guy who could slip on a banana peel, or the MTV VJ who could cheesy host, or Dirt Nasty, my music persona. But I was never looked at as like a real actor until now. So I would love to do some serious, you know, dramatic roles, and then do some really fun, silly comedies, you know, similar to like, you know, how Robin Williams or Jim Carrey or, you know, some of the best comedic actors do really good drama. So I'm not comparing myself to them, but, you know, or Bill Murray, you know, like some of the best can do both. And I believe that I'm capable of doing both. So I would do my version of that, whatever that looks like, you know.
I mean, I would say some of our most memorable dramatic performances have been from comedic performance. You know, like Monique comes to mind, people like that. Yeah. But coming up, you're in a movie with Diane Keaton, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Correct, yeah.
I imagine stars of that caliber take to you immediately because you seem, quote unquote, real. I mean, if you yourself are a sociopath, you're hiding it very well. You seem very real. Do people like her just look at you and be like, what is this guy on? I just love it. Are you called neat constantly by Diane Keaton?
Well, we only worked together for one day, but we got to improv together, and I'll never forget. It was just one day of work, and I play a new age bullshit shaman who turns a young woman into an old woman, Diane Keaton, and then I revert her back to a young woman at the end of the movie. And I'm basically like a new age huckster. And we had one day together, and I'll never forget, after improvising with her, she pulled me aside and she goes, "You're good, kid." And I remember that was one of those moments that was like a feather in the cap that I called my mom. I was like, "You won't believe what Diane Keaton just said to me." So yes, she was very sweet with me. We only worked together a day, so I didn't get to hang with her too much. But she did just see Red Rocket and called me up walking out of the theater, hyperventilating. "Simon, oh my God, Simon, I can't believe what I just saw." You know, just did her whole Diane Keaton thing. I'm doing a horrible impression. But working with her. I have another movie coming out with Zach Quinto and Lucas Gage called Down Low, which is a lot of fun. So I got a couple other, those are really broad comedies. So yeah, to answer your question, I think it'd be cool to maybe go another direction next, do some dramatic stuff. But what's exciting is I don't know what this looks like on the other side. I'm going to look at all these offers and pick the right thing. And I just want to work. I'm old enough now I've been caught in that trap before 20 years ago about money and fame and like getting caught up in that, that at this point in my life, I've realized I don't need money or fame to be happy. And it's actually quite the opposite. They both complicate your life so much mm-hmm. that now all I want out of this is to work. If I could get a couple of accolades along the way, great, but that's not my intention. I just want to get more work and have some, you know, create cool shit. So mm-hmm. I think that'll happen. We'll see.
I like that you said that Diane Keaton was a feather in your cap. Well, she probably was wearing a cap with a feather.
So yeah, clearly you had a great experience with Sean Baker. Is there a director that you are like, you're another one that you'd be happy, thrilled to work with?
I love the Safdie brothers. I love Gus Van Sant, who funny enough is the reason I'm an actor is because of Gus Van Sant. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I've told this story a million times, but it's kind of a cool one. When I worked at MTV 25 years ago, Gus Van Sant saw me on MTV and he called me in to audition for Good Will Hunting. And I went in and I read with him and Matt Damon for a very small role of a bully that Matt Damon beats up. It was just two lines. I somehow managed to butcher those lines because I've never acted before. And Gus stopped me and he's like, Simon, stop. You're not ready for this, but you should go to acting school because you have something and I see it. So I went to acting school in New York and started studying like Stanislavski method classes and, you know, putting up scenes from plays, and I just don't improv classes. And I was like, well, if Gus Van Sant sees something in me, I should listen. And I trust him. I love Drugstore Cowboy, Rumblefish. I mean, he's one of the best directors ever. So it would be really cool 25 years later to work with Gus Van Sant. I mean, I could name a million directors. It's really about working with good directors, to your point. It really is. And that's the thing, is I'm getting great offers. But the main thing for me will be like, who's the director?
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite memory from the MTV era? In being friends with Dave Holmes, who has talked about that, like he was there in the late 90s. So he was there at like the rise of Britney Spears, et cetera. It was just an insane Total Request live time. Like so much attention is paid to you. And yet also, I think he was like bartending on the side. It's this like high, low fame situation. Do you have any particular favorite moments from that era?
Yeah, I had a lot. Let's see. I remember interviewing Tupac Shakur might have been one of the top ones because it's Tupac Shakur. And I remember that happening so much because I remember when I worked at MTV, I would meet all these celebrities and I remember being really underwhelmed. And they always say you don't want to meet your heroes because you'll be like, oh, that's it. That's not the magic that I saw on screen. And like, wish I never met them. And not to talk shit, just more like it's better to keep it a fantasy. Mm-hmm. And I remember with Tupac, when he walked in the room, he lit up a room, I think, more than any other human being I've ever seen in my entire life. It was like he was like a god or something. And just being honest, I wasn't even a huge Tupac fan. And I'm from the Bay Area where he is god. You know, he's like from, you know, that's his stomping grounds. And I was more of a Biggie Smalls fan, which you don't say where I'm from. You always got to go with Tupac. But when he walked in the room, I felt something that was so unbelievable. And I'm like, oh my God, I get it. It's not just about his rap skills. This dude is like on another level. So that stood out to me the most. And recently my buddy went into the archives and found the actual VHS cassette. It took weeks and they had an intern digging in these old vaults of cassettes and they found the Tupac interview, and it's on YouTube. If anyone wants to watch it, you can type in Simon Rex Tupac interview and watch it. And it's cringy to watch, but that was probably the highlight of like everybody that I met.
Because of him, we have the movie Poetic Justice and a scene where Janet Jackson says the word punani. So I'm forever indebted and grateful to Tupac.
For introducing the word punani to the lexicon? Or what?
And to me as like a six-year-old. Yeah.
Simon, like you are being very zen and relaxed and appreciative about this entire process, but also you are being interviewed by three high-strung gay guys who care too much about award shows. And so I want to ask you, what is your strategy going into this award season? Because yes, being a good actor, like having a gracious and relaxed approach to an industry you've been in for 25 years, those are all fine things for being a human being. But also you are going into war right now. You have to be proving yourself, what is your strategy? Then let us give you advice.
Okay. My strategy is, my strategy is that I don't know if I have one. It's kind of like what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. Sometimes like my theory in life is like no plan is the best plan and let the magic happen. In a weird way, I feel like the movie speaks for itself. I can step back and let my team who I have around me, who's doing such an amazing job, do their thing. And I can sit here and just have these honest conversations with people like you, because I don't know how much I can control with the outcome of some of these awards. And to be totally honest, I've already won all of these awards along these film festivals and, you know, the LA Film Critics Association and you know, honoree at the Marin Film Festival and Deauville, France. I mean, I have all these Best Actor awards on my shelves right now. I never thought any of this would happen. It could end right now and I won. So anything else is a bonus, and that's truly my attitude. And I was told by a couple people in the industry that on this little run I'm going on, they're like, don't get caught up in the Oscar hype. It's going to make you crazy. Don't read all the articles. It'll drive you nuts. You know, just that's my advice to you is like, don't sit there Googling it all day because it's going to make you go crazy. Yeah. So I try not to overlook because my mom will send me articles. Look, honey, they're saying you're number 7 for a possible Oscar. I'm like, this could drive you crazy. So I'm just doing my best to not download and digest too much articles and things, because it can make, you know, it's kind of a head fuck, you know. I don't know how much control I have over it at this point. I just got to do these things and talk about it and hope that that, you know, the people in the Academy will take to a movie like this, because it is, you know, it is a little edgy for like an Oscar film, yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. and that's okay. I think that's why Sean made this movie. He likes to do movies that make you think and are polarizing and pushing the envelope. Is it envelope or envelope?
If you want the Oscar, you say envelope. So yeah.
Look, here's my advice. I love the way you were talking about just being in the moment and taking what comes at you. Of course, Los Angeles is like, of course, award shows are a head fuck. Los Angeles is a head fuck. You've already experienced the head fuck. What I want to know from a potential Simon Rex victory is that I'm going to fucking cry. I want to fucking cry that you, after the journey and the battle of a career that you have had, for all the ups and all the downs, that you are being honored in that way. I want this level of honesty. Please don't be dignified. I do not want Dame Helen Mirren if Simon Rex wins a fucking SAG award or an Oscar. I want you to be as honest as you are now, because I will fucking weep like crazy.
I also just want to say that crying on a red carpet, if you cried to Ryan Seacrest, that would also help. Yeah. You know, if I see Simon Rex bawling, like, oh, it's all led up to this or whatever, you know, anyway, you know the narrative. Right. Yeah.
So you're saying, you mean if I win and make my acceptance speech, how I handle that? Is that what you mean by that?
Well, yes, but I also think that part of the campaigning is us knowing what we'll get when somebody wins. And I think that's how you handle yourself in all of this stuff. I think that this is a really beautiful approach that you are taking of just being appreciative and respectful, but also honest about everything. And I think that because it will make people will be more likely to vote for somebody if they feel like they're going to get a special moment than if they're going to get somebody, you know, who doesn't show up or is receiving an award for the third time or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think right now we all live in the twilight zone and everything's upside down. So in a weird way, me being here kind of totally makes sense, because nothing makes sense right now, right? So I'm part of this narrative of the world being upside down. So it's kind of like, couldn't be better timing. And maybe that will work to my benefit, because I think times are changing so much. And I think after the last 2 years of realizing what's important during this pandemic, that like maybe we could be more relaxed about things like nudity and sex. It's like, can we just grow up a little bit, guys? Like, you know, as a society and a country, we are so sexually wound up. You know, when we were in Europe doing this movie, they don't give a shit. In America, it's like, oh, he has, you know, he's naked. It's like, okay, and I was born naked, so I don't care. So that's my attitude about it. And, you know, to me, in a weird way, like even just get, like, even if I just got a nomination, that would be like the biggest win ever, even almost more so than winning, in a weird way, because if you win an Oscar, like, where do you go from there? I remember Mark Ronson told me, my friend Mark Ronson, name drop, he won the Grammy for album of the year, song of the year, whatever it was for Uptown Funk. And he told me he sat there with his Grammy for 3 days. Like, I did it. I'm at the top of the mountain. I made it. I'm done. And then 3 days later, it hit him. He goes, oh, shit. Now what?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I got to do the next bigger thing. Like, you can't just kick back. Like, so I think what would come with that would be so crazy. And I still want to be able to just go to a restaurant or a corner store and not be, like, harassed too much. So it'd be kind of cool to be, like, get all the perks of being nominated without being having to hide from the world, like Leonardo DiCaprio or someone who just can't go walk down the street, because that's kind of scary. But hey, look, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. I'll take it either way. I
just want to say also that what Mark Ronson did afterwards was win an Oscar and then become Meryl Streep's son-in-law. So there are places you can go.
He knows what he's doing.
Simon Rex, thank you so much for being with us today. You've been such an expectedly amazing interview, and the movie is so good. You guys must see Red Rocket and see it in a theater so you can have every large facial expression possible to what goes down in this movie.
Yeah, please go see it in the theater. I think it's only in the U.S. theaters for like another month or so, and it's like spread out over different cities. And it's all, if you go to my Instagram, everyone listening, it's SimonRex415, or my Twitter is SimonRex, and I have like the link and the dates and locations of where it's playing. So yeah, go see it in the theater. And if not, it'll be streaming probably in a month or so. But yeah, please go see it, because the movie theaters are dying. And one thing I've learned from this whole festival run is, man, I miss going to the movies. Like, I forgot what this was like. It's like a magical experience that's slowly dying, and we need to hold on to that. And Sean Baker is such a, you know, proponent for keeping us going to the movie theater where there's no distractions. You can't pause it. You can't look at your phone. Well, you can look at your phone, but you're being a dick. So yeah, go to the theater. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We will be right back.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Well, I was hanging out at my favorite comedy club on Sunday, and by that I mean Twitter. And you know what was going on there? The entire Golden Globes. This is what I mean. They didn't broadcast the Golden Globes this year because the world agreed they basically shouldn't exist. And the HFBA hasn't been reformed yet. Yeah. So instead of having any ceremony whatsoever, they simply put on Twitter each of the category's winners. There were, in fact, nominees this year. And the tweets themselves were a spectacle since they were clearly pre-written templates. And there was one famous screw up where in the tweet announcing West Side Story had won Best Musical or Comedy, they said, laughter is the best medicine. And in that case, West Side Story is the cure for what ails you. Like, they were kind of counting on a real comedy to win and instead a musical one. And in fact, it's a musical where it's basically about gang members killing each other. So it wasn't really chock full of laughs. Anyway, it was another embarrassment. But I was just sad not to get a real Golden Globes. I can't explain it. There's something about this award show that in its utter pointlessness, in its utter, you know, being the Palm Sunday before the Easter of the Oscars, I just needed. And I was wondering if you guys felt that abyss also.
Initially, no. Until they finally awarded the first trans actress a Golden Globe. And then I'm like,
yes.
Then that's when you should be televised. When you actually make history, when you finally decide to do the right thing as a company, and you're like, we'll just do it in it's like they might as well just send somebody with bad breath to tell you the fucking winners in your ear. Like, it really was like the worst way to give that news out.
Solomon's referring to MJ Rodriguez, yes, who won for Pose. Can I say something about MJ Rodriguez? Can more people please talk about how she constantly summons the image of Cher to me? Oh. Literally watching her, the way she like moves her face, it's like suspect era Cher. and that's prime, by the way. If you know 1987, it was a very special time for Cher.
I just love the Globes. I miss the Globes. Like, I love that they're a shit show. Like, I love everybody getting drunk. All I want to see is Rita Wilson and Don Gummer sitting around tables cracking wines with the people around them. And it just, it's so sad that, like, the Hollywood Foreign Press dug its heels in so hard about being a weird racist organization. Like, it's the Hollywood Foreign Press. There are lots of foreign countries that cover our films, thank God. You know, it's like we need to be doing more to build ties to other parts of the world if we want to keep making this many movies and having them make money. It would not be that hard to include more people of color in their decision-making process. And it's weird because the Golden Globes are both a fun, ridiculous show, except when Ricky Gervais is hosting.
Correct.
But they are like also a racket. Like they are a weird scam that 87 like half-assed journalists have run on like this city ever since Sharon Stone was sending them Cartier watches so she could get nominated for the Muse. And so like that point is just like become a slightly better racket,
yeah,
because we do love the product that you're making. But then the other point, the Ricky Gervais, like the heights of Tina and Amy hosting versus the depths of Ricky Gervais. And I just like, I have complex feelings about this, but please stop letting straight guys who don't like award shows host award shows. Like, there are perfectly good Billy Eichners out there. Like, there are perfectly good Solomon Georgios who could do Che Diaz. I mean, I think we'd all like to see Che Diaz host the Independent Spirit Awards.
Yes, right.
Oh, God, the rap they would do. But it's just frustrating to me. And I have to accept that, like, one out of half of the Super Bowls, we do get a gay center to an extremely male activity. I just feel like they feel the need to let these dudes host these award shows so that they're not annoying for the guys who watch. And it's like, maybe accept that it's 2022 and guys aren't watching. Women and gay guys are. So let one of us host these shows and enjoy it and have fun with it, because talking about how shitty they are while they're happening is from the 90s.
I have layered thoughts about this. First of all, if Che Diaz is hosting the Independent Spirit Awards, how many seconds in before they say, no one's more dependent on spirits than me? Because first of all, within the first 5 seconds, bitch. I'm writing that monologue, motherfucker. But secondly, no, there's actually now a somewhat serious tradition of the eye-rolling man taking the dais at award shows. I mean, I'm at least happy that there is one famous flop occasion of this, which is the David Letterman Oscars. You know, because to me, the thing that was the worst about the famous moment where he keeps introducing Uma Thurman to Oprah Winfrey and he says Uma to Oprah and he's like just repeating the sounds again and again, like expecting to get a laugh out of it, and it lands with a thud, is that he tried to be so cynical that everyone would be on his side, and instead everyone was like, no, we're trying to enjoy the Oscars. Mm-hmm. Can you just make the normal jokes?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, be Billy Crystal, please, you know?
See, Billy Crystal's a showman, though. Well,
yes,
and that's that's the kind of host you should have. Somebody who's like, you're a performer. Like, yeah, you do jokes as well, but, and like a Whoopi Goldberg's another one that's like, you were phenomenal at hosting, but I don't know. Like for me, like it's always, I feel like they're all such a racket, and the Golden Globes was so obvious about it that I kind of love that. Like, they were a little more hokey pokey about it, and I kind of enjoy that about them. And I'm trying to find the words to say it. It's like watching a high school performance of a musical instead of a Broadway one.
Yes.
The thing I love most about the Golden Globes is that because it is just like 90 people running a racket, like they truly can create moments, and they have consistently like named princesses, like best actress in like a comedy on television. They have been like, Rachel Bloom, you're a princess. Yeah. Gina Rodriguez, you're a princess. And like, I really liked that this year they were saying, like, MJ Rodriguez, you're the princess. But we didn't get to have that moment, you know? And I think that they have had a little bit more of an eye to what the future is when it comes to television than the Emmys, which have a nasty habit of, I mean, they've gotten better in the last couple of years, but there have been so many runs of the Emmys where it was just like, ah, yes, Julia Louis-Dreyfus takes home her 9,000th Emmy. What a different year.
But I have to say, though, that's what I like about the Emmys, because there's something that should be hostile about an award show sticking to its guns. I mean, it's a different kind of appeal than the Golden Globes, which, as you said, is like creating moments. I know I don't have to explain Oscars or whatever to you.
Louis Bertel, are you defending the Emmys, giving Julia Louis-Dreyfus yet another Emmy when Lisa Kudrow for The Comeback was just sitting there? When there was a singular chance to give Lisa Kudrow an award for The Comeback?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think award shows matter unless there are significant snubs. So okay.
That's a great argument.
As a patron saint of a snub, I think Lisa Kudrow has gained some cachet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so
I'm
not saying I don't want her to have that Emmy. And of course, luckily, she already has an Emmy. But that sticks out in my mind. Like a part of me is like, as Glenn Close herself has said, she's like, there's like a pantheon of people who have never gotten Oscars. And it's like nice to be in that company as much as it'd be nice to have one.
It is. Like Susan Lucci not getting an Emmy 17 times in a row, I'll remember for the rest of my life.
And who remembers when she got one?
You know? Yes, right.
I barely do.
That's why I know the name Shamar Moore. Yes.
Lewis, last night I watched The Lost Daughter, and just having a moment of realizing, like, oh, Olivia Colman is now just going to Glenn Close for us absolutely every year.
Oh, right, right.
Was pretty exciting.
Also, I mean, there's a part of me that thinks she's going to take it again. I feel like people are souring on the Kristen Stewart Spencer experience. And like, there's a dubiousness associated with the Nicole Kidman movie, even though I thought she was amazing in it.
Yes.
Whereas something about Olivia Colman feels safe to vote for. I don't know what it is. It's different. Maybe it's like the quote, like the deglamming. I don't know what it is.
But also, like, she did so much in that movie. Like, this almost feels like a Glenda Jacksoning, where you know, it's like, this is her touch of class.
You brought up Glenda Jackson now, which just put me in my happy spot. Guys, if you don't know anything about Glenda Jackson, I think I've brought her up on this podcast before. She is a 2-time Oscar-winning actress who could not give less of a fuck about the Oscars. Like, Katharine Hepburn gave more of a fuck about the Oscars than Glenda Jackson did. And then she left acting and became an MP for years, and then somewhat recently returned to Broadway in Edward Albee's Three Tall Women and won a Tony for that, and then played King Lear in some... another version of that. Anyway, no one's had a more distinguished career and has had harder bangs while doing it.
No, the thing I wanted to say, Lewis, was there is possibly no more definitive test for whether a male child is gay than showing them being the Ricardos. But like, because it's just so uniformly every straight person I talk to, every like is just like, what was that movie? And I went into it as skeptical as humanly possible, and I just walked out, like, I came out of it with like, yeah, she was real good.
Yeah, well by the way, that movie was the second coming of the people who are obsessed with LeVar Burton needs to host Jeopardy are the same people like, why isn't it Deborah Messing? It's like, why? Because like three of you got the idea that like LeVar Burton can famously read, so now he needs to read these clues forever. Like, Deborah Messing, you saw her play Lucy in a sketch one time on Will and Grace, and now she needs to do the biopic of dramatic Lucy. It's like how sure everyone was, contrasted with how ridiculous it would be if we gave somebody a role for that reason, was so strange.
It's insane,
to me.
Especially as I must just love Deborah Messing and Will and Grace. You can see the strength of her acting on Smash. It is not that far.
Faggots have done the research on this. We were there for Smash and The Starter Wife. Was that the name of that movie with Deborah Messing? Oh, okay,
absolutely. She walked out of the ocean.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Happens sometimes. Yeah, anyway, so I kind of worry now that, first of all, the Oscars are still a long time away because of COVID last year, and this year it's like further along in the year than it usually would be. Like, we don't have a proper predecessor to the Oscars. And I again, because like very few blockbusters, well, are one, nominated, but two, very few of the hyper-nominated movies this year are super popular. Mm-hmm. It's like, God, this thing is going to keep deflating and deflating. And I like these movies. I like talking about them, and I like watching award shows about them. But
yeah.
I'm just, there's some peril in my mind right now. I don't know what they can do.
I feel like there should be other award shows that should be bolstered more, like the Critics' Choice Awards or the WGA mm-hmm. Awards. Like, I think those, or the SAG Awards, I think those are really good indicators that are not fully used to their capability.
The thing is like, people, other than the SAG Awards, people don't want those things to be hoary. I guess that, like, if the SAG Awards are a little hoary, but if you could make the WGA Awards, like, more of a thing. But also, no one wants to look at writers. I say this as a writer. but, like, there was something nice about, like, you need champagne and trash.
Yeah.
And I like the Globes for that.
I feel like we can do it with the Critics' Choice Awards. I think they can be sluttied up. I think there's a way.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if I know critics, I mean, those are sluts.
Just one last thing. There is nothing more fun than writing an award show. Lewis, I know you've done it.
Solomon, sure.
Have you ever done it?
Well, I've done it for something that I wrote for a Chinese movie award show that was never televised, that was hosted by Rob Schneider, and it was one of the best days of my life.
It's the best. That sounds like the best fucking job.
Oh, no, I wrote for the Emmys. It was just like,
yeah.
Patter, come on, like, to outstretch my arms and to feel Bruce Valanche come through me to be the conduit for all those novelty t-shirts at once. Anyway, so Golden Globes, we miss what you could be and lament what you are. We'll be right back with our favorite segment of the show, Keep It. And we're back with the downright meanest part of the episode. It's Keep It. Let's tell stuff to fuck off. I'm going to do the rare thing and start with myself. Ira, as you know, is not egotistical at all and would never go first. But I will do it today. My Keep It is to, and I'm sorry to do this because I'm a fan of exactly this kind of thing, Wordle.
Oh, shit.
Wordle is a new word game that mainly, I'm going to go millennials play, but it's a fun format where you get one of these puzzles a day. It's a five-letter word you're trying to figure out. You guess a five-letter word, and then it tells you how many letters you have in the correct position and how many letters are in the word that you've chosen, but they're in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. And so you use that information on a layer below it, and you keep solving it until you get the actual word correctly. First of all, this would not be annoying if, one, people didn't post their quote-unquote results on Twitter, where they post like a diagram that shows where they got letters right and stuff. Guys, I'm not taking in anything from this. I can't, mm-hmm. I don't look at your game and think, here he is, the next Nikola Tesla. Like, what am I supposed to think about you solving a five-letter word? First of all, it's just not that difficult a task. Literally, if you posted the time you completed a crossword, that gives me more information than this would. And also, it's an ugly thing to look at. I don't want to look at like 15 boxes and some of them are green. It's just, it's gross. Aesthetically, I don't like it. And then third of all, did the world forget about the game show Lingo, which existed in the 2000s?
Yes.
It is this exact game. It was on Game Show Network. There's no way it wasn't the most popular show on Game Show Network. It was hosted by conservative enemy Chuck Woolery, who I know I've gone on this monologue before. His most famous accomplishment, aside from hosting, I guess, Love Connection, is that he was the original host of Wheel of Fortune before, in a failed contract negotiation, he lost Wheel of Fortune to Pat Sajak, who famously still has that show. Anyway, it's this exact game where you have a five-letter word to figure out, and then you use clues based on previous guesses to solve the puzzle. Did we forget this? It's all over YouTube. I hate that this is a new game we're playing. I used to play this online all the time. So I'm sad that people have no cultural memory for this exact motherfucking thing. It's the exact game. So...
Also, you can easily alter your score. I've done it already. I've posted once and I just like deleted the rows above. I'm like, see, I got it in one try.
Also, the thing about this also is because there's only one a day, what's stopping you from like using other people's postings online to help you solve it?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So like if somebody posts like a screenshot of their game or something, clearly that would help you out.
Well, you have to know, well, you still have to know the word, like letters they use, because it doesn't give that.
Right. But I have seen people post literally a screenshot of the game they are playing. Like they use the with the letters in them.
Well, that's not helping anyone.
Right. Yeah. Guy, you strike me as a Wordle player. Are you in tears?
I mean, I've done it 3 times. I like that there's deductive reasoning involved.
Sure. No, it's like, do you ever play Mastermind? That old like Milton Bradley game where you have 4 colored pegs and your opponent has to guess what they are, and you basically indicate where they're right and where the order's off. And it's something that would be in a gifted classroom. Like when I was in second grade, mean Mrs. Conlon would just put it out in front of us, and we would have to, you know, become Alan Turing or something. Anyway, that's my keep it. Guy, we'll go to you next, since I believe you are accustomed to Ranker and will share it well.
I would like to say to adaptogens, keep it.
But why?
Because of the temptation of witchcraft. Because like and adaptogens like ashwagandha, or the other day I was getting some kombucha because I needed some probiotics in my life, and there was a weird potion that had adaptogenic mushrooms in it, and I ended up spending like $3 or $4 for a dumb potion that will do nothing for me, but it's always tempting. And I love that adaptogens have managed to make their bullshit promise so vague that it's not even like more energy, lose weight, or anything like that. Adaptogens are just like, well, what you need. These mushrooms will figure out what's missing in your life, and it will be able to like find you a boyfriend or heal your spleen. We don't know what it is.
Something very Unitarian Church about this. Yeah.
Yes. And I like part of why I'm demanding that they keep themselves is that it is such a tempting and insidious promise. And it, like, there's something very, something wicked this way comes, you know, sort of like store full of mysteries, needful things, that kind of thing about what adaptogens are offering. Do I, at the end of the day, think that they are, Satan incarnate? Yes. Like, I feel like this is, essentially, I was trying to think of one of the other names for the devil, but it's like early in the morning.
Beelzebub, yes.
Beelzebub, offering us vague rewards in exchange for our soul or $4. Yes. So keep it, adaptogens.
You're really giving me flashbacks to like infomercials where like they've just come back from the lab with the breakthrough. You know, it's like, yes. And now we can sell it or whatever, anyway.
Like a Ron Popeil kind of situation.
Yes, right, yeah.
At least at the end of the day, you watch the Ron Popeil things happen, the stuff that you put on your feet, and then they are thicker after you are done sleeping because of the toxins have come out of you. You see something where ashwagandha, and like, I'm sure it is good and useful in its like appropriate cultural terms, but as taken by white people and sold to white people, keep it.
There should be a store called As Sold to White People. That should be. All right, Solomon, what are you keeping this with?
I think this is something that's been a dominant part of our culture for the last few years, and I feel like it should have gone away during the pandemic, but it just refused to. And that is, for me, my keep it is grind culture.
I was going to say culture. Ira Madison. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
grind culture, hustle culture, being booked and busy. I really, it's the end of the world. Let's calm down. I think the terminology should just fully die. Relax. Like, at the end times, I think we're not partying and having as much of a good time, and people are just being very focused on work, and I don't care for it.
Yeah.
I feel like we should scale down what's the word I'm looking for? Hope. And working that hard. I feel like it's just that toxic positivity of like, if you just put your fucking head to the ground, fucking just do whatever you gotta do. I'm like, I don't care for it. I never liked it. I don't enjoy it. And I personally want to die.
I also just think like, and I'm not like a chronically productive person, but even during the times when I am awfully productive, there's no such thing to me as feeling like I've done enough.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna like focus on that as a high, I just feel like you're always gonna come up short. Cause like, yeah, you'll hit it one day, and then the next day you won't, and then that'll be on your mind. It's sort of like exercise. Like, yes, you can never like get to the I did it point. Like, you never graduate, you know?
Yeah. Cause I've like, for me, like I growing up in an immigrant household and having that extremely hard work ethic my whole life, I just, you know what? I'm like, I feel like my parents worked that hard so I could take 2 naps a day. And I'm gonna now.
I'd like to make 2 points. The first one is, I have long hoped that COVID-19 just makes us Europe. Like, after all of this, we're like, 6-hour workday, sure, we don't need to get that done. You know, like, maybe you can't reach someone on the phone until after they're done having lunch. Like, that's just the way it's going to go. My second point, Lewis, that was a very interesting point about with exercise, you're never there. That's why I think that is, like, there is a there, but only for the you on Instagram. Like, you eventually capture that perfectly realized you, and then that person gets to look down on you as your body decays and fails.
Setting up your own enemy for years. That's nice. I'm actually obsessed with fitness messaging on Instagram and TikTok now, I see, where, like, just fully somebody will start a video with, here's what you're doing wrong at the gym. Yeah. It's like, you don't fucking see what I'm doing at the gym. Why are you coming at me with this from this place of condescension? And yet I'm offended. I want to speak out like they see me, but they don't.
Anyway. It's all inaccurate messaging. I feel like it's just, I feel like we don't give the, like, rest needs to happen. And I think, like, it's just the way capitalism works is effectively making you think that being busy is you being successful. And it is not. I feel like the most successful people do the least amount of work during the day sometimes.
Well, no, but that's the thing, is it tells you busy being is being successful when you are your own capital.
Yeah.
For workers, for people whose time is all they have. All the people who have capital are just pushing it around a little bit, then getting on the boat.
Yeah, exactly.
The only busy I support is Phillips. I've said it before. When she holds a plank on Instagram, I'm right there with her.
Exactly.
That was a good talk show. She did a good job.
It was.
Also, by the way, she is a fine actress. I just want to say that, like, when you watch her in anything she's ever done, going back to Freaks and Geeks, I'm like, man, you are so lived in.
Yeah.
Anyway.
She's a character actress. I think they never get the respect they deserve.
Yes, right. She has, like, a fucking rad look, too. I like the look in her eyes. Anyway, can you believe it? I can go on about 90s originating actresses for a long time. This has been Keep It. I've had such a lovely time with, of course, you, Guy Branum, and you, Solomon Giorgio, again. Let's resume this at Akbar while we scream along to... I'll be dressed as MC Scat Cat.
I'll be Paul Abdul in the cold-blooded, cold-hearted snake video, which is always...
Oh, and we can explain to some child that that's based on the movie All That Jazz, which they probably haven't heard of.
Well, I'm going to be at the Arlington Draft House on the 21st and the 22nd in Washington, D.C. So if any Keep It listeners are in the greater Washington, D.C. area, they should come and look at me do stand-up comedy if they are comfortable.
Washington, D.C. You know who's from there? The wonderful Tori Amos.
Oh, wow. Oh, actually,
who has a great new album? I just want to say that too. I'm plugging Tori Amos' new album. Yeah.
Well, I actually will be doing stand up myself February 18th and 19th in Seattle, Washington at the Crocodile, the famous Crocodile Cafe. So if you want to see me in February, I guess you can. I don't recommend it, but you should.
Wait, what city was that?
Seattle, Washington.
Oh, Seattle. That's where Eddie Vedder is from.
He might be. I've heard rumors. I'm from there. I'm also from there. I grew up there.
Next week, Ira and Aida will not be back again, but I will be. And God help me, I hope that's enough. We will see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Caroline Reston. And our associate producer is Brian Semmel. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III, that I, Lewis Fertel, do a good job too. Our audio engineers are Charlotte Landis and Kyle Seglin, and the show is mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action. Not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.